Welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the fastest growing segment of society. To those who know that the world's political, religious, military, media, and economic institutions are corrupt, that they are counterproductive, and that they cannot be fixed. Our mission, therefore, is to look behind the headlines, to know who is working against our interests, to understand why they are doing so. Because exposing and condemning errant and treacherous schemes isn't hateful. It's appropriate, it's rational, it's caring. In our second hour, we're going to use evidence and reason today to continue to explore the many ways that Christianity is wrong on everything that Christians believe. Then in our third, we're going to turn to the Torah and continue to explore what Yahweh, that's God's one and only name, has to say in his teaching, that's what Torah actually means, about his one and only covenant and how you can participate and how you might benefit. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, is toll-free. Anytime over the next 3 hours, you're invited to call in. 877-300-7645. In Washington, the U.S. State Department, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security warned that terrorists may try to smuggle explosives on Russia-bound planes using toothpaste tubes. Yes, indeed. America, we have met the enemy, and the enemy is toothpaste. Toothpaste-wielding terrorists are out to get you. You need your government. You need your Department of Homeland Security, the ATF, the FBI, the CIA, U.S. Customs. You need them all, backed by the largest military on earth, to protect you from toothpaste-wielding terrorists. Never mind that terrorism is a tactic and that trying to identify the cause, the motivation, the identity of those who wish to do harm, particularly to civilians, cannot be ascertained from describing them using a tactic. But the problem isn't toothpaste. You ought not be worried by toothpaste. Go ahead and brush your teeth as you always have. But with each new warning from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, you may want to question your government's sanity. Speaking of government insanity, Seoul, South Korea. North Korea on Thursday threatened to cancel reunions of families separated by the Korean War, accusing the United States of flying nuclear B-52 bombers on training missions over the Korean Peninsula. Yes, we made a mess in Korea, in the Korean War, lost a lot of lives. And now to keep that fight simmering, even when the North and South agree to allow relatives who have been separated by the DMZ for all of these years to simply hug one another again, the United States does the sensible thing and flies nuclear bombers. It's a wonder that someone doesn't just scratch their head and say, you know, all we are doing is making a bad situation worse. The deal that was reached between North and South Korea to hold family reunions was the first in a very long time. The first that these relatives would have had the opportunity to hug one another since 1953, but it is for naught because America was threatened by this reunion and decided to fly bombers over the region. I read an article that was sent to me yesterday. Its headline reads, Norway, 90% of all violent rapes in Oslo are committed by Muslims. The summary of total rape statistics, dominated by 50% in total by Muslim immigrants, coincides with similar figures in Sweden. it is important to pay attention that Muslims, who comprise 1.5% of the total population in Norway, stand for 50% of the entire country's rape statistics. Islamo-apologists often try to distort these facts by claiming Muslims only raped, and to suggest that the fact that 90% of rapes in Oslo and 50% in the country at large were perpetrated by 1.5% of the population isn't fair, because that means that there were rapes perpetrated by others, so we shouldn't single the Muslims out. But the moment you do that, you lose all sense of connection. You lose the ability to understand. Back at the time that I was writing the Islamic terrorism timeline, it became increasingly obvious that Muslims, starting in 1960, were committing about a third to maybe 40% of the terrorist acts around the world. And they represented about a fifth of the world's population at that time. Then, over time, as OPEC became wealthier and there was more fuel behind Islamic terrorism, and particularly Saudi Arabia began to build more fundamentalist Islamic mosques around the world, that number rose. And it rose rapidly, to the point where by the 70s it was nearly 50% that was perpetrated by Muslims. In the 80s, it was in the range of 70% of terrorist acts worldwide were perpetrated by Muslims. In the 90s, it was up in the range of 90% perpetrated by Muslims. And by the time we reach the 21st century, it's in the range of 99% of all terrorist acts worldwide are perpetrated by fundamentalist Muslims. Now, that is even more alarming when you realize that Muslims are still a minority of the world. There's 1.7 billion people in the world, and only 1.5 billion of them are Muslims. And when you make that connection, you realize that there's something dreadfully wrong with Islam. There's a direct and undeniable connection between the tactic of terrorism and Muslims. Muslims are vastly more likely to commit a terrorist act than non-Muslims. Speaking of the abuse of civilians, the Iraqi security forces that America empowered, that America pays for even at this moment, that America enabled, are detaining thousands of women illegally and subjecting them to torture and abuse, a new report by Human Rights Watch claims. Many have been held for months. Some have been held for years without any charge. More than 4,500 women are currently being held in prisons across Iraq, according to the 105-page report titled, No One is Safe: The Abuse of Women in Iraq's Criminal Justice System. The vast majority of them are Sunni Muslims. Why? Because the United States replaced a secular dictator in Iraq, Saddam Hussein, with a Shiite government that is controlled by mullahs out of Tehran. So the Shia government that America empowered is now abusing Sunni Muslims. And of course, not only are Sunni Muslims lower than dogs in their view, but women have no rights at all. So not only are the vast majority Sunni Muslims, it is an equal opportunity hater, in the sense that there are women of all sects and classes that are being affected. Yes, because, of course, we have to abuse Christian women, too. And there's still a few left. Many of those interviewed described being beaten, kicked, slapped, hung upside down, beaten on their feet, given electric shocks, and also raped during interrogation by the security forces that America empowered and still pays for. Sexual violence was so commonplace, let's call that rape, when you're when you are sexually gratifying your carnal desires on a captive, it's rape. Sexual violence, rape, was so commonplace that employees at women prisons facilities are quoted saying, "We expect that they've been raped by police on their way to the prison. Even before they get to the prison, they're raped by the police force America established and empowered." Contrary to Iraqi law, most of the female detainees have no access to a lawyer before or during their interrogations, the study found. Of course not. In Sharia, women have no rights. You have a religion that treats half of its population like rubbish, like a possession to be abused. You know, to say they treat them like a dog is unfair, because in the West, we have a tendency to think that dogs are pretty neat animals, and that when we are nice to them, we find that they are extraordinarily kind to us. And we have this tendency to be nice to our pets, but in an Islamic country, women are savaged. They're raped, they're abused, they're manipulated. Their genitals are savaged by their own mothers. They're beaten, they're starved. It's one of many reasons why the entire world should be opposed to Islam. Iraqi security forces, and this is a quote, and officials act as if brutality and abusing women will make the country safer, said Joe Stork, HRW's deputy Middle East and North African director. Yes, the Iraqi security forces that the U.S. military was used to position in power, to train, to equip, act as if brutally abusing women will make the country safer. You know, maybe they did learn it from the Americans, since the American military provides the least safe place for women, the place where they're more likely to be sexually abused than any other place in Western society. Maybe they learned it from us. We'll be back with Shattering Myths after the commercial break. The article that I was sharing with our listeners here in the first segment of our program today concludes with these words. Both men and women suffer from the severe flaws in the criminal justice system in Iraq, but women suffer a double burden due to their second-class status in Iraqi society. It is astonishing. And this was a quote from the watchdog agency that was there, Human Rights Watch. It's astonishing. It's just absolutely astonishing. Human Rights Watch does some good work. They are correct that women are routinely raped in Iraq. They're imprisoned. They're beaten. They're treated as animals. They have no rights. It is, and the situation is vastly worse as a result of our invasion of Iraq than it was previously in Iraq. Vastly worse. We made a bad situation worse with our military intervention. I mean, that's just the facts. But why would they say Iraqi society? It's no different in Syria. It's no different in Egypt. It's no different in Saudi Arabia. It's no different in Pakistan. It's no different in Afghanistan. Why would they say second-class status of women in Iraqi society? Are they completely out of touch with the ubiquitous nature of the abuse of women throughout the Islamic world? There's a website that sent me an article. The website is called Myths and Facts. The byline of the website reads, "The truth may not always win, but it is always right." I would perhaps change that. The truth might not always prevail, but it is always right. This article, there is much in it that is important for us to understand, and it's well written. It has some issues in that it speaks of a people called Palestinians, even though there is no such thing. It speaks of a conflict against Israel being dominated by Arabs as opposed to Muslims. And they use Arab instead of Muslims throughout the discussion. But beyond that, if you can get beyond the poor use of an accurate use of terms, there is something to learn. This is being written in rebuttal to the United States and the peace process being promoted by the United States. It reads, "The weight of the evidence of so many scholars, observers, pollsters, and monitors make it almost impossible to mitigate, not to mention ignore, the enormity of finding a solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict." Now, again, if you view this as an Arab-Israeli conflict, then you have missed the point. And this fellow has, I'm sorry to say, you've missed the point. There is no way to find a resolution here so long as you dress this up as Arab-Israeli as opposed to Muslim-Israeli. But nonetheless, the man makes some good points. He writes, "When one grasps the duration of the conflict and its roots, when one fully faces the depth of the animosity towards Israel and the anti-Semitism that permeates the, in quotes, Arab world, from the political, religious, and intellectual elites down to the grassroots, the sheer magnitude of the challenge for peacemakers becomes painfully apparent. The roots of the Muslim-Israeli conflict go back 1,400 years, when Muhammad invented Islam. Initially, his enemy, through the first 90 surahs of the Quran, were his neighbors, his own tribe, his relatives in Mecca. But then he was driven out of Mecca in shame after the satanic verses, after the wild ass rides to Jerusalem, to the non-existent temple. En route, after being made a mockery of himself in Mecca, Muhammad ran into a minority of the Arabs living in Yathrib, today's Medina, which was principally a community of Israelites. Three-quarters of the population were Israelites. And Muhammad declared war against all humankind in his meeting with the Arabs there. And then when he arrived in Yathrib, he systematically robbed, raped, enslaved, and murdered every Jewish man, woman, and child in Yathrib, today's Medina. That's the root of this conflict. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're talking about a article that was posted on a site called Myths and Facts. They have a great deal, a great number of very important insights combined with some myths, truths, and we're working our way through that article. That second paragraph reads, "When one grasps the duration of the conflict and its roots." Of course, they didn't say when the conflict began or its root, and I'm here to tell you that the conflict began 1,400 years ago when Muhammad fled from Mecca to Yathrib, today's Medina, following the satanic verses, and he began to systematically murder, rob, rape, and enslave Jews, hunting them to the point that in the last year of his life, in the 10th year of the Islamic era, Muhammad had to change his enemy, or add Christians to his enemy would be a more correct term, because he had overhunted Jews. That is the start of this conflict, and its roots are in Islam. If you're not willing to address Islam, if you're not willing to talk about Islam, then you're wasting your time in discussing a peace process in Israel. Then it says, when one fully faces the depth of the animosity towards Israel, well, to face that and the anti-Semitism that permeates the Arab world, from the political, religious, and intellectual elites down to the grassroots, the sheer magnitude and the challenge of peacemakers become painfully apparent. But even here, he won't address it. It's just as if the whole world is afraid to embrace the truth. Here's a site that says, you know, the truth may not always win, but it's always right, and yet he can't say it. Why? Why can't he say it? Anti-Semitism exists in Islam because the Quran is more anti-Semitic than is Hitler's Mein Kampf. Much more anti-Semitic than Hitler's Mein Kampf. I'm not saying that because I want to be outrageous. I'm saying it because it's true. You know, in Prophet of Doom, it's a 1,000-page review. The most comprehensive, the best documented, the most contextual and chronological presentation ever written of the five earliest Islamic sources. And in that book, it became so obvious that the Quran was more anti-Semitic than the Nazis. I devoted 77 pages of that book to juxtaposing Hitler's comment in Mein Kampf with Muhammad's comments as they're found in the Quran and Hadith. That's the reason that we have a sheer magnitude of a problem, and that anti-Semitism permeates the Muslim world. It's not resolvable. And to resolve the problem of Islam, you may not like that conclusion, but that's the reality. It's why yesterday and the day before, I was so harsh on those who have bought into the myth that the U.S. government planned and perpetrated 9/11 in their conspiracy theories, as they call themselves, as this fellow does, a truther. If you disassociate Islam from the perpetration of 9/11, then you miss everything that's important for you to know. The same thing is true here. When one admits the implication of Palestinian society's behavior, the repetitive pattern of over 90 years of rejectionism on the diplomatic front and the penchant for terrorism amongst civilians, the readiness of Arabs for coexistence and the chance of a breakthrough assume their true proportions. Once again, there is value to the statement, even though it's filled with errors. There have not even been people known as Palestinians for 90 years. The first mention of a Palestinian person dates back to sometime in the 1950s, in terms of the popular media and popular society. 1950s. 1950s is 60-some-odd years from ago, not 90. There were no Palestinians, even mythologically presented, 90 years ago. There just weren't. Even those who were in positions of power in surrounding countries, in Egypt, in Syria, in Jordan, and throughout the Islamic world, the voices of the leadership of the Islamic world, all said, universally, there's no such thing as a Palestinian. There never has been. There is no such thing as a Palestinian society. They're just Muslims. Now, the rejectionism and the diplomatic front is a penchant for terrorism against civilians. The fact of the matter is that Muslims universally accepted every aspect of the Balfour Accord except giving Israel an independent statehood. And because they accepted one and didn't accept the other, it makes their acceptance of one illegitimate. And it means that their claim now that Israel must comply with with an outgrowth of those agreements, and particularly the United Nations, when they rejected UN 242, you can't impose it now. I have negotiated countless contracts, and I always tell people that if you're negotiating a contract and somebody has proposed a term, if you accept those terms, then the contract is binding. But if you continue to negotiate the terms, the contract is not binding. You cause an offer by a party to a contract to be non-binding the moment you begin to negotiate it. And once you negotiate it, you can't go back and say, okay, because I failed to prevail on getting more from you, then I'll go ahead and bind you to what you previously offered. It doesn't work that way. And because the Muslims surrounding Israel universally rejected UN 242, they cannot now go back after three wars and countless rejection to say, we want it imposed. It's like saying that, you know, I want to go to war against Canada, and I'm going to send my military on three massive campaigns into Canada because I want to move the border between the United States and Canada and get my behind kicked, and the Canadians prevailing, and them moving the border south 500 miles. And then me going to the world and crying and said, oh, how unfair of them. They're occupying America. I want my old border back. Now, that's exactly what we've got in UN 242. So under those circumstances, there is no legitimacy to the world's assertion that Israel is occupying Palestinian land. This article continues. The unwillingness to accept Israel as a legitimate non-Muslim political entity is epitomized by the Palestinian asymmetrical demands for the right of return of all Palestinian refugees to the Jewish state, coupled with a demand that the West Bank and Gaza be cleansed of all Jews. While the names are corrupted, the idea is really brilliant. What he's saying here is that the mythical people known as the Palestinians, the Muslims, are demanding that the Muslims that they asked to leave Israel so that Islamic armies could slaughter Jews more freely back in 1948, that even though they've bred like rabbits and have never integrated into any Islamic society, they're still considered refugees, treated as pariahs in Jordan and Syria and in Lebanon, treated like dogs by those countries, that they now be exported out of those countries where they are considered a pariahs, and that they are imported back into Israel where, of course, in a democracy, they would vastly overwhelm the number of Jews, and Israel would quickly become an Islamic state. However, the relatively few Jews who have settled in the West Bank, which is part of Yahweh's gift to Israel, that they have to go. They can't be tolerated. They have to be cleansed from that territory. Now, that position reveals the true nature of the problem and why it can never be resolved. The article reads, so where do we go from here? Is there no way out? And there isn't a way out, by the way. This fellow will pretend that there might be, but there is no resolution to this story. Yahweh has already written that there is no resolution. The Muslims rise up again after Israel is compelled to surrender land at its midsection. It's going to play out just like the Czechoslovakian sacrifice by Neville Chamberlain, going to lead to world war. One cannot artificially narrow the scope of the conflict. One cannot duck the tough issues, whether in the Palestinian camp or the Arab world as a whole. Western leadership is staying above the conflict out of fear that demanding that Arabs, this should be Muslims, walk the talk will jeopardize one's status as an honest broker and will not bring peace. Yes, if you are critical of the Muslims and say, you know, we don't negotiate with terrorists. You know, the only group that America and Europe negotiates with for the mythical Palestinians is the PLO. That's Fatah and the PLO are the same organization. It's a terrorist organization. You know, the United States should just say, we don't negotiate with terrorist organizations. We can't negotiate on your behalf. We don't cave in to bribes from terrorists. But no, we are unwilling to tell the Muslims that we can't offer you land for peace because you know nothing of peace, only of terror. The article continues, true peace cannot be based on a lie. There has never been a cycle of violence. This is the man's most resounding point. Resorting to such neutral terminology requires the United States to acquiesce to and to perpetuate a gross misrepresentation of reality. It's a point I have made so many times. We will continue with this thought when Shattering Myths continues after the commercial break. It is an important one. Please stay tuned. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're covering an article that was written on, posted on a site called Myths and Facts. The truth may not always win, but it is always right. This was the point that the author was making, which is important for us to consider. And it is this lack of understanding that is so central to promoting the myths of a peace process in Israel. It says, true peace cannot be based upon a lie. There has never been a cycle of violence. Resorting to such neutral terminology requires the United States to acquiesce and to perpetuate a gross misunderstanding of reality. Putting Israel and its neighbors on the same footing totally ignores the asymmetry of the history of the conflict and something as fundamental as cause and effect. The truth is, one side has been the aggressor time after time. By the way, it goes all the way back 1,400 years. One side is always the aggressor, the Muslims. He says the Arabs, the Muslims have been the intimidators for more than five major wars, political and economic boycotts, and unbridled incitement. The Muslims, he writes, Palestinians, have launched wave after wave of terrorism against Israelis and other Jews and have made hate the fuel that directs and runs their society. All of this began before there was a state of Israel, before there was a quote-unquote occupation, and continues unabated to this day. Cause and effect. History. Truth. Perspective. Understanding. These are all such important things, and these are things that so many people are either unwilling or unable to process. In response to these onslaughts, Israel has not demanded reparations for the horrific casualties that it has sustained in its fight for survival against repeated, it says Arab, Muslim, aggression. It has only asked that it be allowed to live in peace with recognized and defendable borders and to develop according to its own Jewish ethos. This is hardly an excessive demand. You know, I do have a problem with Israel and the Jewish ethos. My problem is that I don't much care for political entities that are based on race. I don't much care for political solutions that are based upon religion. Now, he is completely right that Islam is to blame for the violence that has been directed against Jews for 1,400 years. And that to make this sound like there is a conflict between the two, as opposed that one is the attacker and the other is the defender, would be as foolish as looking at the Holocaust as anything other than anti-Semitism of Nazi Germans. And and of Europeans in general against the Jewish population. The Jews did not strike and engage in a conflict that caused the Holocaust. They were victimized, just as Israel is victimized by this constant onslaught of Muslim aggression. We need to understand cause and effect. We need to understand history to have any opportunity, any chance whatsoever to be reasonable as people, to move from ignorance to knowing, and then from knowing to understanding. But I'm not an advocate of a religious state. In fact, I am against it. I am not an advocate for a racial state. I'm even against that. We ought not divide the world into religious and racial ideas. But that is the goal of the Israelis, because they view themselves as a tiny minority, about 15 million Israelis worldwide. Now, they would differentiate between Israelis and Jews in a different way than I do. Yehudim, which has become Jew, is one of 12 tribes from Yehuda. And so it's inappropriate to use Jews in that context. And Israeli isn't someone who lives in Israel, a Jew living in Israel, which is how they would couch that concept, but instead a member of any one of the 12 tribes would be an Israelite. On our program, probably on Monday, we'll continue with this letter, because it is something that will help our understanding. We'll be back after the news.